This is A Sharp Outlook on TalkZone.com, the show that helps you grow your business and enrich your life. Now, here's the host of A Sharp Outlook, Angela Sharp.
Hello, and thank you for joining us at A Sharp Outlook on TalkZone.com. We are the show that you want to tune into to listen to topics that help to empower you as an entrepreneur, as visionaries, business owners, and gives you the insight needed to achieve self-determination empowerment. At the end of our last segment, we will have an opportunity for you to call in on our Ask Me segment to give your questions to our guests and get information that you need to be successful. We're thanking everyone for listening in today, and I truly hope that you will enjoy our show. Our show today is called Rehabilitation or Prevention. You choose. And this is one of the things that we want to discuss today. There is a science behind prevention, behavioral health, and community wellness. What is being done with this research is what we will learn today. The statistics and how we approach the problem determines our success in resolving issues of substance abuse, suicide, and teen death due to DUI. Behavioral health is a state of mental, emotional being and or choices. Our actions affect wellness. Substance abuse and misuse are one set of behavioral health problems. Others include, but are not limited to, serious psychological distress, suicide, and mental illness. Such problems are far-reaching and exact an enormous toll on individuals, their families, communities, and broader effect on society. Let's consider these statistics. By 2020, mental and substance abuse disorders will surpass all physical diseases as major cause of disability worldwide. The annual total estimated societal cost of substance abuse in the United States is $510.8 billion. With an estimated 23.5 million American age 12 and older needing treatment for substance abuse. Each year, approximately 5,000 youth under the age of 21 die as a result of underage drinking. More than 34,000 Americans die every year due to suicide, resulting in approximately one suicide every 15 minutes. Half of all our lifetime cases of mental and substance abuse disorders begin by age 14 and three-fourths by the age of 24. In 2008, an estimated 9.8 million adults in the U.S. had a serious mental illness. The science of prevention looks at the above issues empirically and systematically in an attempt to identify root causes while utilizing evidence-based practices and principles to address these problems. We as a society must acknowledge we have a problem and begin to address the behavior in its early stages. Are we our brother's keeper? I would say yes, we are. And so we're going to have this thought-provoking discussion this morning. My guest today is Frank Margarillos. He's a senior certified prevention specialist and a SAMHSA Strategic Planning Framework national trainer. Frank holds a master's degree in prevention science from Oklahoma University and bachelor's degree in cognitive behavioral psychology and intercultural communication from the University of New Mexico. He is a prevention consultant for several New Mexico counties' DWI programs, including the Bernalillo County Department of Substance Abuse Programs. Frank is also the executive director of the New Mexico Credentialing Board for Behavioral Health Professionals and the founder of the New Mexico Prevention Network. Frank is also an adjunct professor at the University of Oklahoma, where he develops and teaches prevention science classes for Oklahoma's University Master of Prevention Science program. Frank is also a national board director for Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Well, Frank, we welcome you to the program today so that we can find out how we can choose prevention instead of rehabilitation. Thank you, Frank, for joining our show today.
Thank you, Angela. Good morning to you and good morning to all our listeners. It's a pleasure to be on your show this morning. And I'm very excited at the opportunity to share some information with you and our listeners, because as you were reading those statistics, every time I look at them and I see them, and invariably they get larger as time goes on, it's a staggering issue and a problem. And if we do not address it, if we do not try to do enough prevention in the front end, clearly the problem will not dissipate and will not get smaller. It will just get larger.
I agree. I have done some volunteer work over my years, and I spent 15 years in Seattle, Washington, and I dealt with working with homeless people and working at the drug and alcohol rehabilitation centers and also the women's shelters. And one thing I know is that we have to begin to talk to our youth about changing behaviors and thinking about choices so that they're not ending up at the back end of this trying to be rehabilitated. So you, as I was reading the program, we talked about a lot about prevention. So there's a study of prevention. So tell me what that is.
Certainly the study or the science of prevention, it's really, in basic terms, it's really to try to go in the front end, to go early on before, to try to prevent or eliminate any risk factor or any ill-advised behavior of our youth. And what it uses, it's a professional field. It's still in its early stages. And what I mean by early stages, the professionalization of the field, maybe the last 30 years or so, 35 years. So it's a new field. Mm-hmm. But it uses an interdisciplinary approach. And what I mean by that, it takes from other sciences to come up with solutions to these problems. For instance, it utilizes psychology principles and practices. It utilizes sociology, criminology, systems thinking approaches, and all these other models and principles and approaches that over time we have known that they work and they're effective, and we take them and we apply them to prevention. Because anytime we deal with prevention, we clearly deal with individuals and the environment. So that is really the basic premise of the study or the science of prevention.
Now, when we talk about prevention, because you mentioned, you know, criminology and some of the other things and sociology, so I know that they have come up with programs and they've had their analysis and their research, but I also see so many people that are incarcerated, so there's something wrong with the prison system, the criminology, their statistics, or however it is they felt the rehabilitation system was supposed to be working. So are you able, when you're looking at their data, to pull out the best of what they're doing and also noticing what didn't work?
Angela, that's a great question. Actually, believe it or not, that's really the easy part of prevention and what we're trying to do. Clearly, we have pulled data, we have looked at statistics, we have looked at what works, we know what doesn't work. Just to give you a quick example, we know, for instance, Nancy Reagan's campaign way back to just say no to drugs, it had limited effect, but I mean, just a simple message as that, to just say no, that's just clearly not enough to change behavior and to change attitude. So we know one-time approaches do not work. We know that we need a comprehensive approach. We need to get everyone involved in society. So we really, really have a lot of science and a lot of research behind prevention of what works, what does not work, and what we need to fix the problem.
I agree. I'm a licensed foster parent, and I've been a foster parent for the past 5 years. And I realize some of the children that are in the foster care services have experienced things that I would never have dreamed that a child, and I will call them children because they are of the age that I wouldn't consider them even knowing of some of the things they've participated in. And so I strongly believe that prevention is necessary, but every adult listening, we are our brother's keeper, and we really have to begin to participate in these programs of preventing our children from engaging in some of these problems. And I also notice that even some of the communities, they don't seem to be catching on to, it's our responsibility to have prevention. So what are the challenges in getting community and legislative support?
That's a huge challenge, and it comes down to our negative side of our human nature as human beings. Politics, clearly that's a huge issue. Turf wars, money, control. So we have a lot of community leaders. We have a lot of community organizations that are doing fantastic work out there. But when it comes to somehow, some way, systematically bring them all together, put them all on the same train, going down the same tracks to address all these issues that are related. One organization may be doing violence prevention. Another may be doing underage drinking prevention. Another one may be doing bullying prevention. Well, all of these are very related. They're all addressing risk factors in the community and trying to increase protective factors. But when it comes to really close systematic collaboration, it's very, very difficult, because then all of a sudden, you know, the devil is in the details. You have funding issues, money, who's going to get the money for this, who's going to get the money for that. We have an archaic system from our government of going out for grants to where, you know, they choose the best proposal and they just fund that program and that's it. We really need to have what I call, and a term in the field we call, collective impact. Mm-hmm. And until we can really make folks understand that we're all facing the same challenges and we all have the same goal, we have a very difficult time getting there. But we are making improvements in that area.
I truly understand what you're saying, because I've worked on the side of grants, and it is a matter of, you have people that have their programs, and there should be more collaboration and working together, because truly, if you look at everyone's mission statement, it's the same goal, mm-hmm. and that is to get the behaviors to change, to stop the abuse and the suicides, to make our communities healthy and whole, and we have to begin to trust one another, that we're not in competition. The one thing you did mention, though, when they're applying for the funding, then it becomes a dog-eat-dog situation. So then the competition begins, and you try to harm another agency so that you can look, you know, better and achieve more dollars. And that competition is probably the worst thing to be doing when you're talking about programmings that are resolving social ills. And so I would think that someone in government would understand this is not the best way to provide the funding for these kinds of services. There has to be a better way. They need to rethink that process so that you have collaborations and not competition, because no one wins in that kind of situation, especially when you're dealing with, you know, programs. Do you agree with that?
I couldn't agree more with you, Angela, absolutely. And that's where leadership and strong leadership and pragmatic leadership and transformational leadership really comes in. And some things are happening, some good things are happening in the horizon. For instance, back in 2009, for the first time ever, all the departments of the U.S. federal government, all 19, 20 departments, I don't recall how many there are, the heads of those departments, they got together. They spent a year on developing, on listening to their stakeholders, listening to experts, and they came out with the first ever national prevention strategy. Mm-hmm. So we actually have a plan in place to where it talks about collaboration. It talks about getting community organizations together. It talks about local governments and Native American communities and ethnic groups and everyone else getting involved in collaborating and changing the system to where you have different funding streams for different things, to where you have what we call a braided funding stream, to where all the funding and all the grants come from the federal government and they're connected. So it's happening, but just like anything, you know, it's like trying to change a huge ship to turn around. It takes time, but it is happening. So I'm really excited about that part of it.
Oh, I am too. That's good to know. And that gives people who are applying for grants an opportunity to understand they are looking for a more collaborative way of doing business. We're going to take a quick break, but right after the break, we will continue our conversation about rehabilitation, prevention, and it's our choice.
Now, back to more of A Sharp Outlook on TalkZone.com. Here's Angela Sharp.
Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in to A Sharp Outlook, the place to tune in to get information for success. And we're talking today about rehabilitation or prevention, and for us to choose. We're talking about making a difference in our society for drug abuse, suicides, and the ills in our society. And our guest today is Frank Marilos, and we're going to continue our conversation. So, Frank, just before the break, we were talking about funding and the challenges and getting community and legislative support in prevention. And I'm also wondering, because some of the products that people are using to become addicted are manufactured. And I'm wondering, what are manufacturers doing to support the efforts of prevention? I know when the tobacco industry lost their lawsuit and had to start doing some kind of prevention, and they have the concessions law and different things like that. But what other kind of things are manufacturers do to support these efforts, or are they?
They are, and they're not, Angela. This is an extremely important and also an extremely complex issue. The main thing we need to understand is these are huge businesses, tobacco industry, the alcohol industry, and so forth. And of course, they sell a legal product to folks that are, you know, that are allowed to use it over 21, for instance, for alcohol. And we have to understand that their main purpose is to make money. And they need brand loyalty. They need loyal customers. They're no different than any other brand, like soda, Coca-Cola, McDonald's, you name it. It's just that it so happens if their products are used and abused, could have deadly and do have deadly and negative consequences. So, for instance, the alcohol companies, they do offer a lot of different prevention programs, but we have to understand on the other side of that, they're doing a lot of advertising and a lot of things that are very negative. They have a very negative influence, and they attract youth. For instance, any kind of a sporting event, basketball, football, NASCAR racing, all these things that young kids also watch on TV. If you look at the branding, you see Budweiser plastered everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, they claim, yes, we are helping, we're doing this. But on the other hand, and we have research that shows that they really market their products to youth, even though they will deny that publicly. The other problem with this, when you have folks that are doing prevention and you have nonprofits and local organizations that are doing prevention, if they accept money from the alcohol industry, it really sends a negative message and a mixed message, especially to our youth. So it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, we lack funding. We will never have enough funding in that type of resource to address these issues, because it's going to take human resources. If they take the funding, it'll be great. They can have programs, but research shows that it sends mixed messages. So from what I know and from research, it's really not a good idea for organizations and those that are doing prevention to directly accept money from the alcohol industry or the tobacco industry, because it just doesn't, especially for youth, it sends mixed messages.
Yes, it does. And I agree. I notice that every sporting event, it sends a message that you can't enjoy the sport without alcohol in your hands. And a lot of the adults, I'm not saying all, but there's a significant number of adults that are at these events that overindulge in their beverages and become inebriated and loud, and, you know, the behavior becomes, you know, bad. And some people may think that that is entertaining for the moment, but they don't understand what happens when that person goes home, and the violence and the abuse, mm-hmm. or possibly an accident on the road. So there's a lot of responsibility that needs to happen when we're talking about tobacco and alcohol. And I know they put the little labels on the side, but when you have gone out and advertised and pushed your product to the point that people feel like there's something wrong with you if you're not smoking or you're not drinking or you're not taking drugs, then we definitely are sending the wrong messages to society, especially when we have statistics like I read at the beginning of the show. We are the adults, and we are the ones who need to set the ground rules for the next generation. And I personally don't want my grandchildren becoming addicted to drugs or any other type of product that is out there that's harmful to their bodies. So, I mean, I'm not saying that people that want to choose that, but I think there needs to be a responsibility in all of our choices, whatever they are, because I, as a foster parent and someone who's worked with homeless people and those in the rehab centers, sometimes just saying no is not enough, like you said before. And so society needs to take responsibilities, and manufacturers need to take responsibilities. There was a day there would be a member on the board of directors that would say, what is our social responsibility here? And they would, you know, kind of change the behavior because of the effect on society. But it sounds to me like money has taken over.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. And one thing I want to point out, too, all these things we're talking about, by no means we're advocating on we want to advocate for prohibition. The majority of adults, for instance, when it comes to alcohol, they're responsible drinkers. It's the smaller percentage that creates havoc in our roads and so forth. Mm-hmm. So we're just asking, like you said, for responsibility, and especially for our youth, because we want our youth to, their brains are not fully developed until they're 21 or the mid-20s. So we don't want them to be using these things that we know are harmful to their brains.
Right. And I agree. I'm not speaking of prohibition whatsoever. I'm saying responsibility. We have to be responsible in everything that we do. That's where choices comes in. We need to learn how to choose and how to choose wisely. And always remember that someone else is watching. What is my behavior? What's the message of my behavior? What is it sending out to my son who's sitting beside me? So it's about just being responsible and making the right choices, and that's what I'm wanting to emphasize today. What are the main prevention approaches? There's a lot of prevention study there, you say, and so there must be approaches to how you're handling this prevention.
Absolutely. There's two main things, and a lot of different things fall into these two main categories, is what we call direct services or individual approaches. And this is where, for instance, you would have an evidence-based school curriculum for the youth, or you would be doing prevention sessions and so forth. So these are called direct services. The other main approach is what we call the environmental approaches or environmental strategies, and these are things that involve the entire community and entire populations. For example, a social marketing and education campaign. Here in New Mexico, we have one of those campaigns. It's called the Be Above the Influence campaign, to where we involve the entire community via many different methods. So those are our two main things. And the biggest thing on this prevention approach is we always must be cognizant to use what we know works, to use evidence-based strategies, and to also be able to evaluate our results. Otherwise, the field will not improve and move forward and do better work for our communities and especially our youth.
Can you explain to our audience, when you say evidence-based programs, what exactly are you talking about?
That's a great question. What I'm talking about is programs that have been rigorously evaluated by very high-level researchers. For instance, there's a national registry that has over 150 to 200 of these evidence-based programs. It's called NREP, the National Registry for Evidence-Based Programs and Practices. And these programs, we know if they're implemented with fidelity, the way they're supposed to be exactly, we follow the protocol, they have been known to work. So that's the basic definition of evidence-based. They work for the population we chose, in the area we chose, the age group, the developmental appropriateness, and so forth.
Okay. I just want to put a little shout out for those that are working with programs, that are working with grant dollars, that are working with different types of programs that are affecting society and our youth. It's very important to track your statistics and to track the results of what your program is actually about, because that information is used to create even larger programs that are going to make a difference in society. So I just wanted to put that little note in there for those that are listening. Let's try to track our information.
Great point.
Yes. What are some specific examples of intervention? Can you explain that?
Sure. There's one program, it's called Protecting You, Protecting Me, for instance, and it's geared towards elementary school youth. And it's an 8-week program to where, for example, it's developmentally appropriate because the youth are so young. The specific words like alcohol and so forth are not even really mentioned. I think they're mentioned maybe once or twice in the whole 8 weeks. But the program involves things like to be safe and to take care of your brain by being healthy, by eating well, nutrition, and so forth. One great thing that we find out by using evidence-based programs, even though you're trying to protect these young kids from later on using drugs and alcohol, you are also protecting them from other things like and you're making them more their well-being and their health, because behavioral health and prevention is really about ultimately well-being.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to also mention, because we're talking about alcohol use and drug use, but I also wanted to also mention the fact that sometimes poverty can mm-hmm. cause some of these ills and this state of hopelessness because of such in-depth poverty in some communities, especially our Native communities. And our children end up having, you know, a sense of hopelessness. Do some of these prevention programs or studies or classes or advertising or whatever it is that you present to the adolescents, do they deal with that? Because I think that's also an issue.
They do. They do.
Okay.
And actually, poverty, that is one of the biggest, if not the biggest risk factor that we face in the communities. And especially, like you said, Native American communities. My state here in New Mexico, we're a very, very high poverty state. You will find, just looking at basic statistics on all the ills and all the risk factors and all the bad things, the poverty levels, it has an inverse relationship. The more poverty that exists, the higher the risk for all these things. So mm-hmm. absolutely, all these programs, if they're evidence-based, they address those things. They address cultural considerations. One of the biggest things that we always harp in the field is to make sure that whatever we do, evidence-based and so forth, it's also culturally appropriate. That is absolutely paramount, because you cannot do one program
that's
geared mm-hmm. towards an urban community versus a Native American community, because the culture is different. So
yes.
All that is addressed. That's why it's so important to use evidence-based programs that have been evaluated to address these things.
Great. We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we want to talk even more about prevention and rehabilitation. It's our choice.
Welcome back to A Sharp Outlook on TalkZone.com. Here again is Angela Sharp.
Thank you for returning, and those that are just tuning in, we are discussing rehabilitation and prevention. You choose, and we are talking about how to be able to prevent drug abuse and alcohol use in our society. And so we're going to continue that conversation with our guest, Frank. And Frank, I wanted to talk about the SAMHSA Strategic Prevention Framework. What exactly is that?
That is a great model. It's a planning tool, And it really allows not only those that are in the prevention field, but also communities that are doing prevention. It really allows them to plan correctly and with evidence on how to implement whatever the biggest challenges and problems they face in their community related to substance abuse issues. And the model consists of five basic components. Those of us in the prevention field, we usually like, to just go right at it. Okay, we hear that there's a underage drinking epidemic in our communities, so we want to go out there and just do programming and do it right away. But if we do that and we don't follow specific steps, we could have not the results we want. Sometimes we may do more harm than good. We may not have things that are developmentally appropriate. There's all sorts of issues by not following certain strategic steps to doing our prevention work to have the biggest possible impact. And the first step on the strategic prevention framework is assessment. And what we mean by that is basically having an inventory of exactly what's going on in our community. If we think we have an underage drinking issue, we need to have some statistics. Usually these are things that already exist. It's not necessarily to do a community assessment from scratch. Typically, 99% of the time, these statistics are readily available from your local Department of Health and other agencies. So we only need to look at the prevalence of the problem and how bad it is and how prevailing it is. And once we have that, then the next step we need to look at, the next step of the model is capacity. We need to look, okay, underage drinking is the problem. What resources, financial and human and other assets do we have in our community to address this issue? And once we have a good handle on this, then we can start planning. Okay, we have this amount of money, we have this many staff, we have this many volunteers, we have the churches on board, we have businesses on board or what have you. Now we can plan on choosing our programs. Maybe we'll choose both an environmental strategy, we'll do a media campaign, and then maybe we'll do underage drinking prevention in the middle schools because we found out that the biggest issue is like the transition between middle school and high school, and we need to start earlier. Mm-hmm. And then, and only then, after we do these three steps, do we go to implementation, which is actually going out there and doing the work. And then once we start our work, then we evaluate ongoing what our work is doing and how effective it is. So these are the five basic steps: assessment, capacity, planning, implementation, and evaluation. And within this whole model, in the middle of it, is sustainability and cultural competence. And cultural competence, we talked a little bit about that in the earlier segment. We really need to be responsive in what the problem is, but we also need to be respectful of our population and their needs. So that's critical and paramount in all the steps. And then sustainability. We need to know if we're effective, are we going to have the resources to continue this? Because we can't have population level change in 6 months or a year. These are things that take deep-rooted problems, as we know, they come over years, so it would take years to address and fix these things. So that's why sustainability is so important also. So that's the basic premise and the basic concept of SAMHSA's Strategic Prevention Framework. And it's a fantastic framework that has been used nationwide, and it can be used in a lot of different settings and a lot of different contexts.
So is there training to be able to do this program? I mean, who performs and analyzes the assessment data?
Okay, that's two questions. First, the training, yes. There's training. There's always some sort of training. This is what I'm trained to do on a national level, and this is a 7-day. It's a very comprehensive training. So it's not 7 days. It's a week, 5 days, 5 full days training, and then the assessment data. If you need to do assessment data from scratch, then an evaluator needs to be hired to do it. But a prevention specialist that has enough expertise or a program manager in prevention can typically get this data from their local departments of health, Here in New Mexico, we have the Youth Risk and Resiliency Survey that comes out every 2 years. We can look at data for all the youth in New Mexico, and we can analyze that. And typically, you would have, when that happens, you would have a task force or you would have a planning council. You really need to involve as many community stakeholders as you would, and you look over this data and you come up with a plan on how to go about it.
So you're saying, like, in a rural or urban and even in tribal communities, the practitioners there are capable of doing these assessments in the communities?
Yes, 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 absolutely, especially if they take the training and they are in the field of prevention. And typically most of these folks are connected to the departments of health and their health services in their communities. So, and even if they do not have expertise in analyzing the data, every state has an epidemiologist department, and all they have to do is just call the epidemiologist and say, well, this is what we're looking at. So the information and the help is there. The difficult part is to connect these folks and to have them realize who to talk to and connect them to the right people to get the information.
Is there like an annual conference that speaks of this where people would be able to go to find out more about it so they can get involved and take it back to their communities? Is there an annual conference or?
There's not an annual conference specific to this, but there are many, many conferences in many states, and we can talk about resources a little bit later on of different national organizations that they do have conferences regularly that they talk about this. But every state has a state entity person that's involved in prevention, and they know, understand, and they have accepted this model from SAMHSA. And by the way, for our viewers, the SAMHSA stands for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's part of the U.S. federal government.
Okay. What is the development framework?
That actually, that is a great question also. That deals with of when we're doing evidence-based prevention, it's not mm-hmm. enough just to say, okay, here's a curriculum or here's a, we chose from the National Registry and a prevention program and we're just going to go out there and implement it. We really need to have a basic understanding of the developmental appropriateness of something, of any of these programs. Because, for instance, what you're going to use for an elementary school population will not work for a high school population or for a college population. So we really need to understand the theory behind the developmental framework. And the framework really speaks to how there's different developmental stages between mm-hmm. populations.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually also talks about the interconnectedness to different areas of our community and different spheres. For instance, we have our youth. That's one area or one domain or one sphere. Then we have family. It's like a circle expanding. Then mm-hmm. we have the community, then we have culture. So when we're doing something developmentally appropriate, it's not only important that it's developmentally appropriate for the individual population, but is it also appropriate in these different community settings? And there's different models for this. There's resources out there. It gets very detailed and very specific, but it's a mm-hmm. tool, and it gives us an idea of what we're doing is working for the right population in the right setting.
I'm just curious as to whether I know when you're going in doing programs that affecting not only individuals, but you're talking about, you know, you're dealing with the adults, you're dealing with the elders, you're dealing with the whole community. How difficult is it to get the buy-in to participate or be a part of or start this program in communities?
It all varies, but it could sometimes it can be extremely challenging. The biggest challenge for the prevention world is getting to parents, to do programs with parents. And it's not really that parents do not care or they're not interested, but imagine, for instance, a single parent that has a full-time job and they have to take care of their children. There's really very, very limited time in these parents to really go somewhere and be given, even though it's a free intervention, and be given, you know, prevention resources or a program for them that would help them. So that's our biggest challenge. And we do have ways to address that. For instance, I think one of the biggest things we can do is go to where the parents work with the employers and say, mm-hmm. could we once a month, could we have a meeting with your workforce? And could we talk to them about underage drinking or some of the issues?
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways to get around it. We just have to be smart on how we're doing things. Schools sometimes are very challenging and difficult to get into, especially with a No Child Left Behind. They have all this testing. They have all these things. And they say, well, we don't really have time. We really like your program. We really don't have time to come in. And then you have to show them, okay, these evidence-based programs, they actually tie into all the standards of the No Child Left Behind. And you just have to, it's really salesmanship. You have to be mm-hmm. a great salesperson in the field of prevention. And you
right.
have to have great communication skills. But there are challenges, but like every challenge, there's also a solution.
Right. So, in fact, what we're dealing with is we have a situation where we need to educate the population as to what we really need to be doing to not just keep rehabilitating people, but preventing some of the behavior. And without them understanding it, without them having the knowledge, it's difficult for them to make the time. Because
right.
you would rather, when you're thinking about it, I would rather prevent a problem than to have
sure.
to try to solve it and deal with all of the issues that are related to the problem that I'm having. But a lot of people, if they don't understand, they're not educated on it, then they resist it or they just won't make the time. Mm-hmm. We're going to take another break. And after the break, we're going to continue our conversation. And this next segment, we're going to have callers to call in and ask your questions of myself and Frank. The number is 888-463-6748 or 1-888-GO-FOR-IT. So give us a call and give us your questions.
Welcome back to A Sharp Outlook on TalkZone.com. Here again is Angela Sharp.
Thank you for returning to A Sharp Outlook on TalkZone.com. We are opening our lines for you to call in and to ask questions, but we're going to continue our conversation on rehabilitation or prevention. You get to choose. The number to call in is 888-463-6748 or 888-GO-FOR-IT. So give us a call. We want to hear your questions. So as we continue our conversation, I wanted to ask you about system thinking and how it relates to prevention.
This is a great segment of the show. I'm glad you brought that up, Angela. That really kind of puts the whole thing together. Systems thinking, it basics is really looking at our world as a web of interdependence. We cannot really solve problems by just addressing them only in the microscopic view. And what I mean by that is we tend to address symptoms, and we have to address symptoms, but that's all we're doing. For instance, if we address underage drinking and we eliminate it tomorrow, guess what? If we do not address root causes, then the youth will go into another substance that could be doing prescription drug abuse or meth or you name it. So it's extremely important to have to also, when we do prevention, to think and systemically.
Mm-hmm.
We really need to look at the whole system, because when we think of addressing root causes, we really need to involve not only the youth, not only parents. We need to involve every single segment of our society. We need to involve the whole system, even areas that we think they may have nothing to do with prevention and what we're doing. Because the system has really no boundaries. It's the boundaries we put on it, and it involves everyone.
Yes, I agree. As I mentioned before, I have worked at the alcohol and drug treatment centers, and one of the things that I always tried to address was to go and find out, why did you ever make that choice in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of them, they see the results, but they still go ahead and take the chance. And some of them were dealing with childhood traumas, or some of them were dealing with abuse, or some were dealing with, you know, a mental illness. And so without us actually getting to the root causes, we can have all the advertising in the world and say, you know, this can cause addiction, or this can cause a health issue. It's not going to change anything until we deal with what is causing the anxiety that pushes a person to begin a behavior of trying to inebriate themselves so they don't have to deal with what's happening in their life. So it really is a community issue. It is a national issue. We have to be more connected. I know when I grew up as a little girl, my neighbors knew me just as well as my parents. So they knew whether I was supposed to be outside or if I was supposed to be down on the corner, and they would come and, you know, ask me, what are you doing here? Does your mother know you're here? So it was like we had a little community that protected the children and watched out for them. And, you know, you almost had 10 mothers instead of just one. So we have to become more involved and know our neighbors and know the children in our neighborhood so that we can do more prevention or system thinking so that we don't have the ills that we have today.
And that goes back to collective impact that we talked earlier, to break down the barriers, to not have the competition for the money, and to really have everyone being on the same track, on the same train, going down to the road of wellness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We just need to become more relational as a society. We've become so divided and divisive, and we're just not communicating, but it has had an impact on our society, and we are beginning to lose this battle with the drugs and the alcohol, and like you said, you know, meth and bath salts, and now we're taking caffeine, and so there's something that's going on, and it's happening in our youth, and we need to start finding out what's going on in their head. The bullying, there's a lot of peer pressure, but there's something else going on, and I think as adults, we need to say, I care about the next generation, and I want to know what I need to do to make sure we have a healthy society within our youth and the next generation. I noticed that, you know, as I was reading background information about this, there's also prevention workplace challenges and solutions. What do you have to say about that?
There are a lot of challenges in that area. When it comes to professional prevention science individuals, we have a very strange field in as far as employment and as far as individuals working in this field. Anyone can get in the field of prevention. There's no specific requirements. There's no standardized national certifications that everybody agrees on. So we kind of tend to start our workforce and then get them trained later. And that's really backwards. We really need to professionalize the field more. We really need to get away from those just one-day training workshops to where you learn mm-hmm. about something. We really, really need to professionalize the field. So that's where leadership comes in, as what we were talking earlier. We need the federal government. We need national organizations. We need big players in every state to come together and standardize some of these things and make some requirements. I know it would be more difficult for professionals to get in the field, but we would actually be doing them and our society and our youth a great service by doing this. So those are some of the big challenges. The other big challenge is just like mental health and treatment. As a society, we always think of the physical disease model. People get sick, we recognize that, we spend a ton of money on that, and we really do not spend that much money in comparison to treatment. And if you want to think of even less money and very microscopic, a grain of sand money, is the field of prevention, to where arguably it's the most important, because, I mean, we even have studies that for every $1 we spend on evidence-based prevention, we get anywhere from $10 to $16 in return. You're talking about 1,000 to 1,600% return on your investment. And for every dollar we spend on prevention, we spend anywhere from $50 to $100 in treatment down the road. So clearly prevention needs to start becoming more center stage. But again, we have the politics, we have the money, we have, you know, if prevention gets more money, is treatment going to get less? Is the physical health going to get less? So we really need to get away from those things and really have a collective impact and a common goal.
Well, Frank, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I would like you to let our listeners know how to get more information or to contact you for assistance in a program in their particular area.
Certainly. I would be more than happy. I will give everyone my personal professional email. It's preventionworks@msn.com. Just like it sounds, one word, preventionworks@msn.com. Feel free, anyone out there that is listening, to contact me. Any questions, any my lifelong goal is just to help advance the field as much as I possibly can. And so I would be more than happy to help. Some resources on the national level, a lot of information, and I have to mention Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They're in every state. Everything they do is community-based. It's free of charge. Get a hold of your local Mothers Against Drunk Driving chapters. Tremendous resource for the community. They don't only deal in drinking and driving issues, but they also deal with underage drinking and risk and protective factors and everything else. Another huge resource is CADCA. The acronym is CADCA, and it stands for Community Anti-Drug Coalitions of America. They're a great national organization, and they have tons of resources and information on everything on substance abuse from alcohol to other things. And then a third one that I want to mention is the NPN, which stands for the National Prevention Network. Mm-hmm. You can Google them. Every local state, every state in the country has a state coordinator, a state prevention coordinator that is linked to this national organization. And there's contact information. Just Google that, and you can contact them. And if all else fails and you need more resources, and I have tons of them, just email me at preventionworks@msn.com.
Okay. Thank you, Frank. Thank you so much for being on our show today. I know we have learned a lot, and I'm hoping that our listeners are inspired to be involved in preventing behavior instead of waiting for rehabilitation. Thank you for tuning in to A Sharp Outlook, and look for us again next week at 8 a.m. Pacific time to hear more good topics.